Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for Three Women, Three Ways. My sound bed just didn't play there, so I guess I could have started humming, but I'll spare you that this morning, and we'll figure out what it is with the music by the time we get to the end of the show. Thank you for joining us today. Interesting show today, I think. Well, of course, I'm prejudiced. I think they're all interesting. I'm Heather Stark, and I'm your host for Three Women, Three Ways, and we're doing a show today on healthcare. Different aspect, I think, for the last, 5 years at least, we've been talking about healthcare, but we've been focusing on accessibility and affordability. What can people afford? Can everybody get healthcare that they need? And then we, went into this new era of healthcare reform. But again, the focus for most discussions that those of us outside of the field have focused on accessibility and affordability. Well, turns out there's much more to it than that, and we're going to talk a little bit about those other aspects of healthcare. One of the things that made me think of this topic is my physician that I've had for 20 years retired, and her associates took over her practice, and then about, 6 months later, they decided to go to a concierge practice, which we can talk about later, but I didn't want the concierge practice, so I had to find a new physician. Went locally and discovered that I had an appointment with a physician's assistant, which is fine, but I just didn't know that. They kept referring to her by her first name. And then when I got there, I had like two or three visits there, and discovered that every time I went there, there was no doctor. And finally, I just asked them. I said, I'm perfectly happy with the care that I'm getting, but is there a doctor here? And that made me start to think about, I know so many people who go to physician's assistants now. So that's something that's a little bit different. I'm not sure if it coincides primarily with the Affordable Care Act, but it's a little different. And so I started looking at some of the other things that were a little different and discovered that there were a lot of them. So I decided to do this show today, and I'm very fortunate because I have as a guest Lyle Larson. Lyle is a preeminent physician's assistant and PhD and just all sorts of impressive stuff. I have his CV in front of me, and I must say it's impressive, it's extensive, and it might be easier for me to just have Lyle explain a little bit about himself and his work. Welcome, Lyle.
Well, good morning, Heather. It's a pleasure to be here.
So thank you for joining us.
You want me to explain what I do for a living, huh?
Yes, yes. Could you do that? And we have, 15 seconds?
No. Sure. Well, I'm in an academic institution. I'm here at the University of Washington Medical Center here in Seattle. I'm on the faculty of the School of Medicine and practice in the Department of Electrophysiology. So my primary role here is to instruct cardiology residents and fellows on how to implant permanent pacemakers and implantable defibrillators. It's not exactly why I went into this profession. I actually graduated from University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in 1983. So back in the day, my goal was to go out into a small rural community and pretty well function as an old country doc, if you will. Due to the way that things happen and life starts, I ended up in a specialty and then subspecialty practice. Came to the University of Washington in 1986. And have spent half of my time in cardiology, the other half of my time in cardiothoracic surgery, and also have an interest in administration. So I've been the chief physician assistant here at the University of Washington for the past 15 years or so.
Wow. And you have, is it fair to say that your focus is scientific or sociological? What is your philosophical approach?
My philosophical approach is two-pronged. One is on an academic level. How do we teach, and how do adult learners learn, particularly learning a profession like medicine? And the other interest is one of administration, particularly healthcare administration. How is it that we have gotten to where we are? What are we doing in order to move us forward? And are we doing the right thing? So those are my primary interests.
Okay. So do you want to answer those questions for us in 25 words or less? Are we doing the right thing?
Are we doing the right thing? I think that we are trying. However, I'm not really certain that we are on the right track. And before I proceed any further, I need to provide a disclaimer to make sure that the listeners know that the opinions I give are mine alone and do not reflect those of the University of Washington. So just to make sure.
Yep. And you are allowed to have your own opinion. We value those separate opinions, actually. So, as I said in my introduction, what brought me here was my personal little journey in this changing healthcare environment. One of the things that absolutely shocked me, and then it made sense, is as a woman, and as a woman of a certain age, I'm used to going in and being told, okay, you have a mammogram every year or 2 years. You have a pap smear every year or two years or whatever it is. You have your colonoscopy every 3 or 4 years or whatever. When I went in to this new physician's assistant, I said, well, I haven't had a pap smear in like 3 or 4 years. And she said, well, at your age, you don't need one. And I went, oh, really? You're not at risk for that type of cancer anymore after you reach a certain age? And she said, oh, yes, you're at risk. It's just that the cancer is so slow growing that you'll probably die before it would kill you anyway. And I went, how slow is slow? You know, what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I plan on living another 30 or, you know, years are here. I mean, how long does this cancer take to grow? And is your definition of long the same as my definition of long? Mm-hmm. I mean, who decides these things? And is this new?
This is, unfortunately, this is not new. This is where medicine has been heading for the past 20 years. So if you are old enough to remember the days of Marcus Welby, MD, and television shows like that, where the doctor would come in, the doctor would make all the decisions, everyone would do whatever the doctor said, and that was that. That's a lot of the perception that particularly the older baby boomers and the greatest generation still function under. That's not how medicine is currently practiced, however, because medicine has advanced more in the past 50 years than it has in the past 5,000 years. And there's just too much information for one person to try and hold in their head. Even walking around with an iPad or a BlackBerry or an iPhone, any kind of PDA, you can't keep up. So what has happened is there have been several government agencies over the past 20 years that have developed guidelines and protocols. And so we are now reimbursed for practice based on how well we follow those guidelines and those protocols. These guidelines and protocols are oftentimes scientifically based. Other times they're based on consensus. In other words, there's no good data, but the best guess of the experts should be that we follow this guideline. And so that's how we are practicing medicine today. Now, the unfortunate thing is...
And excuse me for being a bit of a libertarian here, but a government agency then is tasked with deciding the standards for when I get my pap test.
Well, government agencies like the National, National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, the Center for Disease Controls, and any number of government agencies all come out with guidelines. A U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, for example, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So any number of groups. And they also work in conjunction with professional organizations like the American Heart Association, the American Cancer society and whatnot. So we know that it has cost a lot of money to practice healthcare. And the hope is that by using guidelines, we can alleviate some of those costs without missing diagnoses.
The problem with that, as a layperson that I see, is that that's fine if you fit the demographic. That's fine if you are average. But what happens if you're because breast cancer runs in my family, I'm thinking of my daughter. What happens if she feels that she needs something other than the typical? Oh, that's not a good example. Okay, mm-hmm. How about gallbladder disease? Gallbladder disease we typically think of as the female fat and 40, at least that's what they used to say, that's the demographic for gallbladder disease. What happens if you're a 40-year-old plump woman who starts getting that pain in that general part of your body, and the assumption is, she fits the demographic for a gallbladder problem.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if it's pancreatic cancer? Well, they're convinced that we're going to start treating you and examining you and all that kind of stuff based on the bottom line, which is we're not going to throw all these tests at you because chances are it's a gallbladder. What happens to her?
Yeah, that's the frustration that, as you alluded to, the lay public has that frustration, and the medical profession has that frustration as well. If you don't follow guidelines, more and more frequently, you don't get reimbursed. Now, mm-hmm. one of the most difficult things that we have as practitioners is convincing the payers that guidelines are just that. They're guidelines. They're things that you need to think about before you make a diagnosis or before you recommend a treatment plan. So they're guidelines. They're not gospel. Unfortunately, when you deal with some insurance carriers, you have to justify everything that you do, and it becomes a challenge to be able to get the care that your patients really need.
Patients really have to be advocates for themselves, and they have to become knowledgeable about these standards of care in case they don't fit them, it seems to me. And not everybody's capable of being a medical advocate for themselves or for anyone else. So what does a patient do? What happens if I'm that 40-year-old plump lady and I go, you know what, my Aunt Susie had gallbladder disease. This is different. Why do they keep telling me to wait, 3 weeks, come back for the ultrasound, and then we're going to mm-hmm. do this, and then we're going to mm-hmm. do that, and 6 months later we find out it's pancreatic cancer and there's not a darn thing they can do about it?
Sure. Well, the best thing that a patient can do patients have to be advocates for themselves. And I encourage anyone who is a patient, and that means all of us, that whenever you see a healthcare provider, you make a list of questions and take that list in with you. Personally, when I have patients see me, I like lists because that way I know the patients are thinking about their own healthcare. They're taking responsibility for their own healthcare. And quite honestly, many times they will think of questions that I failed to ask them. So the first thing to do is you have to step up to the plate. You have to be your own advocate. As physicians, PAs, nurse practitioners become more and more busy, now that we have another 32 million people with insurance who are all wanting health care now, oftentimes the amount of time that you spend with a health care provider is shortened, and you end up in a situation where it's problem-based medicine. So you come in, you see a provider for one problem and one problem only. You cannot allow that to happen. You have to bring a list in. You have to make sure that your provider knows what your questions are, what your concerns are. And we understand that sometimes patients don't really know what they want when they come in. They come in because they have a pain. They come in because one of their friends had an illness and they think they have the same symptoms. So that's our responsibility to tease those things out. But it's the patient's responsibility to express what their concerns are so that we can help them.
Well, it's all well and good to say, well, the patient, this is your responsibility. This is your part of the deal. Problem being that, as I said, not everybody has the education, quite frankly, the intellect, the understanding. Not everybody can do that for themselves. Is there such a thing as, you know, like there used to be the Rent-A-Yenta program, you know, where, I don't know if you heard of that, that was back in the Midwest many years ago, but a woman actually made a business of, you know what, you have a complaint with a company, I'll handle that complaint for you. I'll be you talking to them and complaining and seeing if I can get some action. I've often thought that people should have divorce yentas so that they can distance themselves a little bit from the emotion and have this person go in there and advocate for you. Is there such a thing as a healthcare yenta, somebody who can go and advocate for the patient with the provider?
Yeah, they're called family members.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
and if you're fortunate enough to have one of those.
If you're fortunate enough to have a family member, you can oftentimes learn more about a patient's concerns from the family than from the patient, particularly in the older boomers and the greatest generation. Now, with the Gen X, Gen Y, and the millennials, they're not shy at all to tell you what they think and what they believe is going on. So you have to, you know, you have to adapt, you know, as a practitioner, you have to adapt your interaction with the patient based on the patient's psychological and socioeconomic status. So, and I don't mean to belittle that in any way. It's just, you know, I talk to, and if I have a patient who comes to my clinic to have his pacemaker checked for a routine visit, an electrical engineer is going to ask a lot more sophisticated questions, quite frankly, than I'm able to answer regarding how his pacemaker works. Whereas, whereas if you have a Russian immigrant who barely speaks English, they may not speak a word through the entire clinical exam, other than trying to find out how they've been doing and how they're feeling through an interpreter, who then again may or may not interpret what the patient's concerns are adequately.
Sure.
So those are all frustrations, and, you know, as practitioners, we deal with those on a daily basis.
Yeah. So, well, you know, and as patients, we have to learn to deal with these things. This is, you know, I'm old enough where I remember where you got sick. I mean, I remember as a child, I reached it. My father was using a saw in the garage. He turned his head, and I touched a bare wire on that saw. And the next thing I recall is I was laying on the couch in my family's living room, and the doctor was there. You know, I mean, this is how old I am. The doctor came to our house. Can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, I go from that era up to today where it's, okay, I don't want to go to the emergency room because it costs an arm and a leg, literally. And so where do I get the health care? I have to bottom line everything. You know, okay, you can put a cast on my wrist, but what happens if I don't put the cast on my wrist? What's going to happen to my hand if I don't do that? You know, I mean, it's like every single thing I have to weigh and balance. Okay, I go in, I've got a pain, and you're telling me don't worry about it, and I'm going, wait a minute, I've been around the block long enough. This is an unusual pain, and this is not something that I think is just... ignore it. So how do I advocate for myself, and how do I tell this practitioner that, no, you know what, I don't think so. I think this requires something else. That's really tough to do, no matter what your educational level, no matter what your personality. It's very, very tough to go to a professional and say, no, I think you're wrong here. I think that this is something different, and I think we need to do more.
Yeah, I agree. It is a very tough and difficult thing to do. However, it's something that you still need to do. You have to be persistent. It's you think about things that intuitively should be easy, yet they're very difficult sometimes for people to do. Things as simple as saying please and thank you. Very easy to do, but very difficult for us to remember to do sometimes. And the same is true in making sure that when you see a healthcare provider, that they listen to you and that they understand what it is that you're asking.
Yeah, And not every, you know, different people can express themselves more clearly than others. So it's a whole issue. It's that whole issue of dealing with your health professional in this age when he or she is getting pressure to do things following a standard format, following a standard, some standard procedures. That's a tough thing to ask anybody.
It is a very difficult thing.
Got a little bit off my topic. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's very difficult. The other thing that it makes it increasingly difficult when they're following guidelines, protocols, and they're doing it under contracted time restraints.
Yes. Well, and that's that whole thing. I about 20 years ago, we decided we got all mad at doctors. Maybe even 30 years ago, we got all mad at doctors because they were gods and they made big money, and we didn't like that. So somewhere along the line, we decided that they had to be chopped down to size. And in exchange, we turned over all this decision-making and profit-making to the insurance company middleman. Am I oversimplifying? Do I sound bitter?
I think that is a bit of a simplification. Although, you know, are you oversimplifying it? No, not really. When we look at the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that we oftentimes forget is that the entire title is called the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So when we relied solely on the physician as the almighty decision maker, we placed all of their trust in him or her. Now, we learned, and there was a pivotal paper that came out in late, I believe it was in 1999, called Crossing the Chasm, when some very, very intelligent and very foreseeing physicians looked at the types of medical errors that were occurring here, you know, here in the United States. You wouldn't think that a country like this would be ripe with medical errors, but guess what? It happens. So, so we took our cue from the airline industry, and if you recall back in 1977, there was a horrible airline accident where two 747s collided with each other in Tenerife, and when the accident was broken down and looked at, it turned out to be pilot error. And why was it pilot error? Well, the co-pilot and the navigator that were in both planes realized something was wrong, but either one of them was afraid to speak up to the pilot. And in one of the airliners, KLM, the chief airline pilot was the safety officer for KLM, and he was the one that was ultimately deemed to be responsible for that accident. And so we have had similar situations with both physicians and surgeons who, to go back to one of your terms earlier, godlike, would make the decisions, and nurses and supporting personnel would not question those decisions. That's changed.
But instead of changing and working on that particular issue, we just took the whole washtub full of healthcare and started swishing it around.
Well, we did, and I think, and this is my personal take on it. So we've worked toward a team-based approach to medicine, and I think that is a very, very good thing. So it's not just one person that's responsible for everything. So it's a team-based approach, but I think that the practice of medicine is very, very, it's very simple, yet it's very complex at the same time. And so it's very difficult to wrap your head around it. The way that I think of it, the way that I explain to patients and to other healthcare practitioners when I speak, is that we oftentimes get confused. So there are three things that we confuse. One is healing. And healing is an art. Healing is something that we all do. if your child scrapes their knee, we fix it. So healing involves compassion. It involves empathy. It involves care. The second component is medicine, and medicine is a science. So the science of just exactly what happens on a cellular level when you have cancer, or what happens with diabetes or pancreatic cancer, things like that. That's a science. And then healthcare is a business. So healthcare is the business of melding healing and the science of medicine together in a way that it can be delivered. And we keep forgetting that. We don't realize that you have to be able to function under all three labels. And unfortunately, we have some that are better at one component than others. And physicians, as a group, I believe, have been forced to focus more on healthcare. And while medicine continues to grow and grow and grow faster than they can keep up, and what takes the back seat with those two is healing, actually caring for the patient. So one of the things that the Affordable Care Act has done is mandated that we all institutions have electronic medical records. And one of the things that I see on a daily basis that frustrates the daylights out of me is you go into an examining room to see a patient, and you talk to the patient, but you're not looking at the patient.
Yeah.
You're typing everything into the computer. Now, why are you typing everything into the computer? Because you have to fill out the little check boxes and whatnot in order to generate a clinic note that will be paid for by the insurance carrier or Medicare. So we're not treating the patient anymore. We're treating the chart.
Yeah. Well, and it seems to me that that's the way we're going. I've been so negligent. I've been so interested in this topic and talking with you, Lyle. I've forgotten to throw out our phone number. If you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation, and I hope you do, give us a call, 646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. And we also have a chat room you can go to. And love to have you join us there or ask a question online through the chat room. You can access that via our webpage. So, again, 646-378-0430. Join us, ask a question, give us your comments. One of the things that you're talking about here is that this whole idea of the business of providing health care, I see that. And I understand that, and I think one of the things that it's important for us to remember is a lot of people that I talk with are so down on the business of healthcare, but you know what, and on the business of anything, but you know what, we're in business, personally. Nobody is working. I mean, we all have to pay for our groceries. We all have to pay for our buildings. And, yeah, you can say, well, your building is nicer than my building, and therefore you're making too much money. We can all say that. But the idea of having something be paid for is not an evil concept. You know, you and I go to work every day, and we expect to be paid for that. Would we do it if we weren't paid? Maybe if we could. But unfortunately, we all have to pay for our groceries and our transportation and our living expenses and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, it really bothers me when people say, well, it's a business, and therefore somehow or other it's evil because money is involved. Money's involved with all of us. So unless we're all willing to say we're evil, I think we just need to lay off the fact that, you know, healthcare and other things, you know, money is how we make things work, and it's not necessarily an evil concept. That's my editorial, Lyle. Do you like it?
Heather, I do. I like it. I like it a lot because it's true. I mean, medicine is no different than any other business, with one caveat. Suppose that you are a business person, and let's say that you sell automobiles, and I come in and I purchase an automobile from you. you expect me to pay for that automobile, whether I pay out of pocket or whether I finance through a bank or a lending company or whatever, and you get that payment, and then I take the car off the lot. That does not happen in medicine. In medicine, you come in, you are given services, you may or may not pay a copay at the time of those services, and the remainder of those services are then billed through a third party, and you hope to get paid within 60 to 90 days. And emphasis on the hope.
But the control is no longer that evil godlike doctor that we decided 30 years ago we didn't like. The control is now all in the hands of the insurance company.
The control is in the hands of the insurance companies who follow Medicare's lead. And Medicare, as we all know, is in the hands of the government. And so as Medicare goes, so goes the health insurance carrier. So when people look at, you know, why does healthcare cost so much money today? And they blame it on their physicians. The physicians are not making the big salaries that they once did. There are so many middlemen in the process now that is one of the reasons why we have seen boutique practices start springing up. So, you know, people are willing to pay to forego the middleman and have access to their physician 24/7, or know exactly who they're going to be calling. If it's not the physician that's taking care of them, then his or her associate. So you know exactly who's going to be taking care of you, as compared to a lot of practices today when you see people on a regular basis, or when you go to a clinic or a facility on a regular basis, you may see Dr. A this time, Dr. B the next time, nurse practitioner C the next time, PAD mm-hmm. the next time, and you don't have a clue when you go in for your clinic appointment who you're going to see. And
that holds true whether you are going to a private office or a group health type of office, or you're just not really sure. And as I explained at the beginning of the show, you know, I've recently been in the position where I had to select a new office to go to, and ended up seeing physician's assistants. And mm-hmm. clearly, I mean, I'm not going to insult physician's assistants here, Lyle. I'm not really, but. When I asked, I said, "Oh, this person is a physician's assistant," and they said, or I referred to the doctor as doctor, and they said, "No, she's not a doctor; she's a physician's assistant." And I went, "Oh, okay. Well, can I see the doctor?" And the response was, "The physician's assistants do everything and can do everything that the doctor can do." And so my response to that is, then why don't they call them doctor?
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand the difference here. I mean, I don't have any objection to seeing. I mean, maybe if I had some, you know, ubla obscure disease, I would want to see the doctor particularly. I mean, I don't have any objection to seeing the physician's assistant. But I think, really, I mean, if a physician's assistant is, I mean, they're interchangeable. Well, don't be ridiculous. Of course, they're not interchangeable. What's this all about?
Sure. So there are healthcare providers that are not MDs or DOs that provide healthcare to patients across the country.
And the MD and the DO are what we call doctor usually.
Correct. The physician assistant profession began in the early 60s when medics were coming back from Vietnam and had a significant amount of medical knowledge, yet there was no place for them to be able to continue to do what they were doing over there. So the physician assistant profession actually was born in North Carolina by a primary care physician who took these people under his wing, and then here in Seattle, the medics program sprung up very quickly afterwards, and there are over 150 PA programs across the country today, roughly 100,000 PAs practicing within the United States today, and in England and in the Netherlands, New Zealand, soon Australia and Japan. So this is something that is taking off all over the world. And the same is true with nurse practitioners. So nurse practitioners, there's a very large number of nurse practitioners. I don't know their numbers right off the top of my head, but you can go
into...
How
is that different from a physician's assistant?
Oh, that's a very loaded question. You're going to get me in trouble here, aren't you?
So, I live to make chaos, yes.
Yes, you do. So if you look at what the state of Washington says regarding physician assistants and nurse practitioners. A physician assistant is educated in a medical model as a generalist in medicine and in a team-based model. The PAs are one out of four professions that are actually licensed to practice medicine, and those four professions are MD, medical doctor, DO, doctor of osteopathy, DPM, doctor of podiatry, and PAs. They're certified. They take a national certification exam, which is administered by the NCCPA, the national. I can't remember what the initials are. It's been way too long. But they're board certified on a national level, and they practice with physician supervision, which can be defined as either direct, indirect, or off-site. So in your case, when you saw a PA...
Which means over your shoulder, in the same room, or you're on your own.
Well, but they practice under supervision. So that PA is trained in a medical model similar to physicians, and they can perform. They cannot perform every procedure everything that a physician can do. That's a bit of an overstretch. But there's plenty of research to show that either a PA or NP can provide about 85% of what a physician can provide in a general practice. Now, if you look at nurse practitioners here in the state of Washington, nurse practitioners are educated in a nursing model to independently assume responsibility and accountability for the care of patients. And take that for what it's worth. They're nationally certified in a specific specialty, so they can be certified in adult medicine, in pediatrics, in geriatric care, whatever. And then they function not under physician supervision, but they function under what's called a collaboration agreement. So they can these definitions vary from state to state, but this is a pretty representative definition for both professions. So a nurse practitioner in the state of Washington could go out and hang his or her shingle and practice independently. A PA in the state of Washington or any state could not and would not. You can get excellent care from either a PA or an NP, and there are studies that showed that the care provided is no less in quality than that of a medical doctor or doctor of osteopathy. In fact, there are studies that show that patient satisfaction having either a PA or a nurse practitioner care for them is on the neighborhood of 93%. And the reason for that is the PA and the nurse practitioner oftentimes will spend more time with the patient and the patient's family than the physician.
Well, and we like, you know, we meaning Americans, but, you know, those of us who seek health care, we like to be mommied a little bit when we're looking for our health care. We want somebody to, you know, who will figuratively at least put the hands on the forehead and check on how we're doing and all that kind of stuff. And you don't get that terrifically often in today's health care environment. So I can see the appeal for somebody who can take more time, somebody who would be able to, give more. I know that's probably a terrible analogy, but to give more of the mommying. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And when you look at the fact that the Association of American Medical Colleges, this was actually written into the Affordable Health Care Act, we should say Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act, so we can remember to protect the patients, is that...
yeah, but I don't feel particularly protected by that. So
well,
I don't feel particularly protected when I don't know who I'm going to or what their qualifications are. I don't know.
Well, you know, again, speaking, you know, for both PAs and nurse practitioners, the Association of American Medical Colleges has predicted a shortage of 150,000 physicians within the next 15 years. And that's going to happen at the same time that we have approximately 10 to 15 million seniors enrolling in Medicare over the next 10 years. So there are going to be a lot more patients out there. And at the, so what the Affordable Care Act is includes is encouraging other professionals, such as nurse practitioners and PAs, to take a major role in providing health care to Americans. So the key, so what the hope of the policy is that these non-physician providers will primarily focus on primary care, but there will be some that seek to practice in advanced specialties, such as me, for example. And when you look at every specialty, every medical specialty and subspecialty, you will not find one, including forensic medicine, where there is not either a PA or a nurse practitioner in that specialty.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I'm looking at our time, and I want to make one comment, which on the physician shortage, simply because I don't think people realize this. Physician shortage is a direct link to this bottom line. Physicians spend how many years, 8 to 12 years, getting their training, a couple hundred thousand dollars, if not more, in student loans and debt, and then they come out, and some insurance company says that averaged over an hourly basis for seeing their patients, you can make maybe, you know, what, $20 an hour if you're lucky? Why would anybody do that?
Well,
why
that's
would
something
any...
That's something that, you know, in an academic medical center, we deal with all the time. So if you, you know, and I think that you've, and Heather, I think you've hit the nail on the head here in your observation, because when you look at particularly, start looking, we're talking about millennials here. So the millennials are in college. They're trying to decide what careers they want to go into. Now, if they decide to go into medicine, they get into medical school, which is a 4-year program. You get out of medical school, you have a 4-year residency, and then you can go into primary care. Most people don't want to do primary care. They want to do specialty or subspecialty care because that's where the money is. So then after your 4 years of medical school, your 4 years of residency, then you do anywhere from a 2 to 4 year fellowship program after that residency. So you're talking about people being in school for anywhere from 10 to 12 years. When they get out of school, they're $200,000-plus in debt, and it will take them their entire careers to pay back those student loans. And not only are they $200,000-plus dollars in debt, but they're also in their early and mid-30s. You compare that person to someone who is in undergraduate school, decides to become a structural or an electrical engineer, goes to 2 years of graduate school, and they're out in their late 20s making as much as a physician without the responsibility of call, without the responsibility of making decisions that have somebody's life into balance. And you know, people are not stupid. They know I can make as much money with a lot less effort and a lot less responsibility. So we are seeing it's becoming difficult to get good candidates in medical centers, at medical schools. It's becoming more difficult to find residents to go into specific practices.
Well, and compare that with, let me see, you go to business school for 4 years, you come out, and you're qualified to be an executive from an insurance company who determines or has a huge say in determining what those doctors get paid,
mm-hmm.
and you're on a career track as an insurance executive, and most of those insurance executives make well into the six figures. Just so you understand, I'm not talking about the people that answer the phone at the insurance company, when you call for a claim. I'm talking about the insurance executives. So okay, I'll get off that soapbox. I mean, for me, okay, if somebody's going to get rich off of health providing health care, I'd rather it be the actual person who's providing the health care. That's just my prejudice. You know, I'd rather the motivator of the dollar sign be with the physician who has to decide whether or not he's going to, you know, palpate this quadrant or whatever, you know, rather than some insurance executive. But
you know,
I
agree with that, although I have, you know, I have Ronald Reagan's voice in the back of my head when he used to say, trust but verify. So we had that system, and unfortunately, it doesn't make any difference whether you are unemployed, a homeless person, or whether you're a CEO in a multi-million-dollar organization. There, you know, people will try and push the system to the best of their advantage, and there are plenty of physicians that have done that. There are physicians that are doing that today and are being caught with Medicare fraud. So paying the provider is a great idea.
Yeah, but let me jump in here. Okay, Medicare fraud is one of my hot buttons. Because about 20 years ago, there was an act called the Kennedy-Kassenbaum Act. Mm-hmm. Before that, in order to be convicted of Medicare fraud, they had to prove that you were trying to defraud. Right. After Kennedy-Kassenbaum, if you billed something, now mind you, as a physician in a physician's office, you know, the billers they can call Medicare and say, okay, we did this procedure, both of these codes work, which should we use, blah, 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 they're both about the same, and you could be advised of which to use. Well, if you use that, and you could use it for 2 years for the same types of procedures, and then Medicare would go, wait a minute, you know, let's go back and look at this. Nope, that isn't the best code to use. It should have been the other one. That physician's office has just committed Medicare fraud.
Well, not only
there was no longer the obligation to prove that somebody was trying to actually defraud the system.
Yes, and so it's actually
gone. So I get my hackles up.
It's gone beyond that now. As a provider, if we overbill, we can be penalized. If we underbill, we can also be penalized.
Yeah. You know, so you have no control. I mean, basically, you have no control.
We have no control, and CMS, Center for Medicaid Services, seems to change the rules almost on a monthly basis, and it is your responsibility as a provider to keep up.
Yeah, and you call in to get advice. You're saying, okay, I'm not sure which of these. I don't want to get in trouble. Tell me which of these. And the person who answers the phone can tell you one, and she has no – it's like the IRS. They are under no obligation to be accurate. If you follow their advice and they weren't accurate, it's all on you.
And that's why most institutions actually have a staff of coders now. So you as a provider will see a patient and dictate a note, and before that patient is billed, it goes to a coder, so the coder can make sure that you put in the appropriate things in your note so they can bill at the appropriate level. And if you forget to put something in, they will kick it back to you and say you need to put this in, or if you put too much in and you try and you check the box where it would be billed at a lower level, either because of an honest mistake or you just didn't think it was really necessary to bill that patient that much, you get in trouble.
And God forbid if you try to give somebody a break. Oh, I have somebody here who doesn't have any insurance. You know what? I'm just going to put it down as a short visit.
You can't do that.
You cannot give people a break.
No. And the Affordable Care Act prevents that from happening.
Yes. So you as a physician, as an individual, as a practitioner, you can't make the choice to give somebody a break. And so
when we're
talking about healthcare costs, why aren't we talking about all that middleman and all that layer and layer and layer and layer that's between the patient and the actual health care? We're not talking about that. Anyway, I am woefully negligent here, Lyle, because I'm having such a good time, you know, ranting and raving. One of the big concerns that I have about health care is victims of domestic violence, victims of sexual assault. how is all of this changing and all of these layers, how is that actually impacting the person who has been assaulted and victimized when it comes to receiving health care?
Well, I think that I think people in that category, it's a tragic thing to have happen, and they tried to address that in the Affordable Care Act. In fact, you know, they put in the Institute of Medicine and put in 8 recommendations for clinical services specific to women, and one of those was interpersonal and domestic violence screening and counseling. Now, having said that, their physicians historically have not been very well trained in medical school on how to address that. That is, thank goodness, that has changed. Particularly when you think that 35% or so of women in this country are either raped, assaulted, or stalked by intimate partners at some time during their lives. So over a third of women go through this. But for healthcare practitioners, we have not done well in talking to patients to ask them if they come in for blood pressure check, so they have hypertension, and we fail to ask them if they're safe at home, then we do that patient a disservice. So there's a lot of education and training that's being provided for healthcare providers to overcome that, and clinicians, you know, we need to acknowledge that the patients, you know, if the patient states that they're in an abusive relationship, we need to acknowledge that. We need to, but most people aren't trained to help them. So it's critical that as clinicians, you know, we offer them a referral source to go to, things like the National Domestic Violence Hotline and a number of other things. But this is something that I certainly struggle with because it's very, very tempting just to say, well, get out of that relationship, or you know, go find the person that's abusing her and give them a piece of your mind. But you certainly cannot do that. So you know, mm-hmm. It's a difficult problem.
It is, and thank you for pointing up the idea and reinforcing the idea that it's not that easy. It's not something you can just walk away from. I had a friend who once was complaining about one of her friends and said, well, she's in this abusive relationship. She won't leave. Why won't she leave? And I said, well, have you asked her? And my friend said, well, she's, and my friend was so disparaging. I'll never forget this. My friend was so disparaging of this third person. And she said, oh, she says she thinks he's going to kill her. And I looked at my friend and I said, then he probably will. You know, I don't discount the notion that she's staying there to save her life. Most people who are killed when they're leaving domestic violence are killed when they're leaving or trying to leave domestic violence situations. So thank you for acknowledging that that's not a simple little decision to just pack the bag and get up and go.
There was a very interesting article out of the New England Journal of Medicine in November of 2012 entitled Intimate Partner Violence, What Physicians Can Do. And there are 5 steps that they recommend physicians take, and it's well worth a read if people have the time, and it should be easy to look up or Google.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you want to give that citation again?
Sure. The New England Journal of Medicine, and it is in the November 29th, 2012 issue.
Okay.
And the title is Intimate Partner Violence, What Physicians Can Do.
Yeah. And just, you know, people who work in the field tend to use intimate partner violence more than domestic violence anymore. We're trying to segue into something that's more descriptive and more accurate. However, most people still think domestic violence when they think, you know, that kind of assault. Another question that I had is, you know, amidst all of this turmoil and amidst all of these new changing standards of care and whatever, you know, that we're seeing, when you encounter a woman that you suspect is in a dangerous personal situation, interpersonal relationship, you can't just come right out and say, are you in a relationship like this? Are you safe? Because, of course, the response is going to be, of course I'm safe. Yes, I'm fine, you know, because it's such a loaded question. What kinds of things can or do you as a practitioner do to try and help folks like that? Or can you? I mean, I imagine that's tough. I mean, you suspect something, and yet this person will not come right out and say it because of all sorts of legitimate reasons on her part. What can you do?
Well, it's it's very difficult. When I was a patient a few years ago, I was asked, "Do you feel safe at home?" That was one of the questions that the nursing staff asked me as I was admitted. So I took that as a cue, so I used that as well. And another question you could ask is, are you afraid of your partner or anyone else? And they will either say yes or no. If they say no, then what you can do is hope that it at least triggers something in them to rethink, to reconsider.
Sure.
Whether they want to talk about it, either to you at this time or to someone else at another time, it gets them to thinking. And if they say yes, then you ask, do you want to talk about it? Is this something that you want to discuss? Or would you like for me to put you in contact with someone who can help you with this? And that is about the best you can do, unless you are trained in this sort of thing. And I certainly am not, and by no means would I consider myself an expert at it. But I do know where I can find resources for them. So that is my role as a practitioner, is to try and identify it, and if it is present, help them get help if they want the help. Sometimes they will say yes. More often than not, they'll say no, but at least it gets them thinking. It plants the seed that hopefully will grow into something that they can act on.
Okay, and then getting back to our previous discussion, then do you have to check off a special box in order to get any kind of reimbursement for seeing that patient?
Unfortunately, yes.
Oh. So then that whole privacy issue comes up. Of course, that comes up with everything, and everybody says, oh, but it's private. If you ever look at that form that you sign saying that privacy policy, you know, read that sometimes. Basically, it says, we will keep all of your information confidential except for what we post on the Internet and somebody can hack if they want to, except for what we can give to your insurance company, except for what we can give to state investigators, except for what we can give to other doctors who inquire, except for what... I mean, why are they wasting the paper with that confidentiality statement that they make you sign?
Because it's required by law.
Required by law, yeah. And so where is our healthcare dollar going? Is it going between the patient and the practitioner? No, it's going to all this other stuff in between. You know, I mean, it just drives me crazy. Drives me crazy. Okay. All right, I've vented. Sorry about that, Lyle. We have chewed up an entire hour, Lyle, and I really appreciate your patience with me. I appreciate your depth of knowledge on this issue. Is there anything that you would like to toss out briefly before we end our segment?
Well, I think the take-home message is that no one really knows what the right answer is yet. We are trying. We are succeeding in some areas. We are not succeeding very well in other areas, and this is going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort, and unfortunately, a lot of money in order to be able to get to a point where everyone can agree. And I would caution people that when they listen to the news and they listen to sound bites, that you will find people who are zealots for the Affordable Health Care Act, and you will find people who are absolutely adamant that it's the worst thing in the world since tornadoes and hurricanes and earthquakes. And the truth is,
it is the devil.
The truth is somewhere in between. And it's going to require a lot of work. It's going to require a lot of bipartisan work in our federal and state governments, and it's going to require a lot of work on our parts as consumers of healthcare to make sure that that our voices are heard. And
thank you,
and
Lyle.
Listen
thank
to.
You so much for that. And my thing that I'm going to throw out there is have somebody go with you. If you have a friend, if you have a family member, if you are dealing with some sort of health issue, have somebody go with you to be your advocate and to help you advocate for yourself. That's my
Absolutely.
Advice. And
Absolutely.
Lyle, I end our segments each week with a quote, and I don't know how you're going to feel about this quote, but it's from a high place. It's from Voltaire. The art of medicine consists of amusing the patient while nature cures the disease. Thank you for joining us on Three Women, Three Ways this week. Next week, we're going to be talking about animals and what our animals do for us. And don't forget, if you missed the segment, you can go to www.blogtalkradio.com/Three Women, Three Ways and catch the reruns and the archive programs. And that's three as in digit. Thank you so much for joining us. And